This is The Takeaway. I'm Kai Wright, sitting in for Tanzina Vega. I normally host the United States of Anxiety on WNYC, Sunday evenings in New York, and its podcast as well. But I will be with you today as Tanzina gets a break. So thanks for joining us.
America's story depends not on any one of us, not on some of us, but on all of us, on we the people. That's the task before us.
It's the first full day in office for President Joe Biden. Yesterday, in one of his very first actions, he sent immigration reform legislation to Congress. The bill marks a sharp turn in the conversation about immigration in the Capitol. It includes an 8-year timeline to grant citizenship to roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States. It also allocates billions of dollars in funding to Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, part of a plan to improve some of the conditions that lead many migrants to leave their countries in the first place.
The U.S. Citizenship Act modernizes our immigration system. It provides hardworking people who have enriched our communities and lived here for decades an opportunity to earn citizenship.
Newly installed Press Secretary Jen Psaki talked about the bill at her first press conference yesterday.
The president's priority reflected in the bill are to responsibly manage the border, keep families together, grow our economy, address the root causes of migration from Central America.
It's a notable change after 4 years of hardline immigration policies from the Trump administration. And although some immigration advocates have criticized the 8-year path to citizenship as longer than they had hoped for, a number of advocacy groups have expressed their support. Meanwhile, prominent congressional Republicans were quick to criticize the legislation. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley and Florida Senator Marco Rubio have both called the proposal a non-starter, that's quote. Senator Rubio, notably, was part of the bipartisan group of senators who led the last meaningful immigration reform debate in Congress back in 2013. And with Democrats' slim majority in the Senate, getting an immigration overhaul done under President Biden will require support from the GOP. Here with me now to discuss is Elora Mukherjee, professor and director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. Thanks for being here, Elora.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
And also with us is Dara Lind, a reporter covering immigration policy for ProPublica. Welcome to the show, Dara.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me on.
So it's maybe a shame to start with the politics and maneuvering of this, Dara, but you know it is obviously going to face a huge hurdle in Congress. And so it's in some ways surprising that President Biden chose to lead with this fight. Why is he prioritizing immigration reform right off the bat?
So it's actually an open question to what extent he is even prioritizing immigration reform. Mm. You know, obviously, there's a difference between having bill text ready to go on day one and sending the message to Congress that this is the thing I want you to do first. And he's not doing that. It's been very clear that both President Biden and Democrats in Congress want to do COVID relief first. And even that, they have said, you know, they may not get a bill on his desk until March. So the question really is, is this bill that was introduced yesterday something that they want to happen immediately after COVID relief, which no one has said explicitly? Is it something they want to happen after COVID relief and climate change? Where does this fit on the legislative agenda? And frankly, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said yesterday, you know, listed his priorities for the coming term, mentioned a few things, didn't mention immigration among those key priorities. So there really is an open question, you know. The Biden administration is sure treating this as something more than just kind of a messaging bill or a vision bill, but how much political capital they actually want to spend on it is really not clear right now.
It's interesting because it seems like a very serious bill. But as you've said, I mean, in previous rounds of this, this would be the whole year's worth of legislative calendar to deal with it. But let's talk about the bill itself. In any case, I mentioned the 8-year pathway to citizenship for immigrants without legal status. What would this actually look like in practice?
So, you know, when people say an 8-year path to citizenship, that's, you know, from the date of enactment and would, for that matter, include any immigrant who's in the country as of January 1st of this year, which is a pretty generous, you know, that's not obviously the only requirement, but it's a pretty generous cutoff point and would go to the point where they would be allowed to apply for citizenship. That's not only shorter than past attempts at legalization have been, but it actually allows them to spend only 3 years after getting green cards to apply for citizenship, which shortens the time for immigrants under current law. That's a 5-year period at minimum. So it's a very, it sounds like a long time, but it's a very expedited path. And then it's further expedited for people who currently have deferred action, who currently have DACA, or people who currently have TPS, under the logic that they have already been living in the U.S., able to work legally, that they have been, they are already kind of in the system in a certain extent, have been vetted, et cetera. It's a fairly progressive attempt at a legalization program by that standard.
Right. And Elora, as somebody who has worked directly with asylum seekers and refugees, what stands out most for you in the proposed bill?
Right. So what stands out most for me is what the administration has done in the past 24 hours. And in the past 24 hours, what we've seen is a welcome break from the unrelenting racism and xenophobia of the past 4 years. Just to put the past 24 hours in context, I want to mention that during the Trump years, we saw about 900 executive actions that changed immigration law and policy that were designed to inflict pain and terror on immigrant families and communities. And while it's remarkable that this legislation was introduced on day one, and in addition to the legislation, what we've seen over the past 24 hours is 7 executive actions designed to bring the United States back into compliance with both domestic law and international law obligations. So what that includes is, first, the repeal of the Muslim ban and the African ban, and a requirement that the Department of State restart visa processing. Second, we're seeing a pause on deportations for 100 days to allow the Department of Homeland Security to reassess its priorities for who should be caught up in the immigration detention system. Third, we see an executive order that's designed to protect Dreamers. Fourth, an executive order that halts the construction of the border wall. Another executive order stops the processing of people into Migrant Protection Protocols, a farcically named program that requires tens of thousands of asylum seekers to remain in Mexico, often in squalid conditions in refugee camps. Sixth, what we saw is an executive order designed to ensure a fair and complete census that counts all people in every state. And finally, we saw an executive order blocking the deportation of Liberians. So whereas during the Trump years, cruelty was immigration policy, it seems that the Biden administration is committed to making the most out of this opportunity to build a fair, humane, and functional immigration system. And there's a lot to be done through executive action, even if the legislative piece of this is more difficult.
Can I just ask you, because you mentioned you ticked through those quickly on the lifting of the ban, the travel ban, what does that actually mean in terms of the lives of some of the folks who have been impacted by that ban?
Right. So the Muslim ban and the African ban are two untold stories of family separations during the Trump years. What this has what these bans have resulted in is thousands and thousands of families unable to reunite because of religious discrimination and national origin discrimination and racism. And what the lifting of these bans does is requires the Department of State to again process visas for the countries that are affected by these bans. And this raises the potential for thousands of fiancés and spouses to reunite with each other, for mothers to reunite with their children, for students from these countries to pursue their dreams of higher education in the United States. This is life-changing for many people affected by these bans.
Dara, going back to the bill itself, so the Democratic Party approach to immigration reform has for a long time been this idea that they would trade ramped up enforcement at the border for pathways to citizenship. This bill seems like an effort at that bargain again. So what's on the enforcement side in it?
So it's not actually. This is really the defining feature of this bill and why there's been so much enthusiasm from the immigrant rights community about it is the Biden administration, instead of, you know, and this is kind of the flip side of what we were talking about earlier about the questions about its path to passage. Like, the reason that it's not at all clear what the, you know, how you can get 10 Senate Republicans on board if you need, you know, if you weren't planning to go the reconciliation route, or how, you know, how you can get this through the Congress, is that it doesn't have the kind of major enforcement trade-offs that we're used to seeing. What they're doing instead is treating this as an opportunity to, you know, take a regional approach, which is something that President Biden was very interested in as a vice president, something that the Democratic Party has really come around on, to, you know, border management instead of border security, and including a lot of American countries. So the question, of course, is how can you, if you needed to get any votes, how would you add Republicans to that bill? And you know, like, if you had to add enforcement to the bill to get Republican votes, would you lose the Democrats and advocates who are so enthusiastic about it now?
Right. And then in terms of the other, are there any other differences sort of in the from the Obama approach in this? You tick through a couple of those, but what else would stand out for you about how this is a big shift from how the Obama administration handled it?
Honestly, when Obama came into office in 2009, their first priority was making it clear to Republicans they were serious about enforcement in order to pass a bill. Instead, with Biden, we have this rapid scaling back of enforcement on day one. So there does appear to be a demand to Republicans to meet Democrats where they are rather than the vice versa.
Right. So that it's not being drawn in one direction or the other, or it's not being drawn to the right as soon as the negotiation begins, which has been sort of the critique of immigration reform for all of these years. And it would not, just very quickly, it would not take effect. The people under who have been in the states since January 1st are the only people who would apply. Correct, Dara?
Yes. But I mean, if this were to somehow pass and get the president's signature, which is not clear.
And Elora, you've witnessed some of the unsanitary conditions for migrant children detained in Texas for weeks by Customs and Border Protection under the Trump administration. Are there steps by the Biden administration that are coming or that we've seen that can make sure that what those children went through doesn't happen again?
I don't have personal inside or knowledge about changes related to the Flores Settlement Agreement, which protects the safety and well-being of children in federal immigration custody. But what I expect is at least minimal compliance with that settlement agreement, whereas what we saw during the Trump years was abject ignoring of the settlement agreement itself. Our country should be treating children with basic humanity and dignity and respect when they're coming into the United States, and I expect that the Biden administration will adhere to those basic minimum standards.
And what about COVID? How do you think COVID has impacted all of this? You know, this has come up when we talk about detention in general, but how do you think it's impacted asylum seekers and refugees?
Right. So the impact of COVID has been that asylum seekers have basically been blocked from entering the United States at the southern border. And there are, inside immigration detention facilities, very dangerous conditions for immigrants detained there. In the words of one federal judge, detention centers holding parents and children are on fire with COVID, is what she ruled over the summer. And what this means for asylum seekers and refugees is that there needs to be put into place systems for allowing asylum seekers and refugees into the country that take public health concerns into account. And there are ways to do this. We can imagine a system that would require asylum seekers and refugees to be tested for COVID before entering the United States, to quarantine for 14 days to make sure that they don't show any symptoms during that period and then to be let into the United States. There are ways for the United States to meet its obligations under domestic law and international law while safely processing asylum seekers and refugees into our country.
And Dara, Laura mentioned earlier the remain in Mexico policy that the Trump administration had. Remind us what this is, and is it now completely gone under Biden?
So the remain in Mexico policy took people who were coming to the U.S. to seek asylum and said, we're not telling you no, but you're going to have to wait in Mexico until we allow you to come into the U.S. for your court hearing. And then after you have your court hearings, if your case isn't resolved, we'll send you back. And so that's resulted in, you know, some 20,000 people being in Mexico while ostensibly having legal proceedings in the U.S. That was put on pause for COVID, and the people who already had court hearings scheduled have now had those deferred kind of indefinitely. The Biden administration last night said that as of today, they are going to stop putting any new people into that program. But as Laura was saying, because the current policy is that you just get pushed back if you come into the U.S. anyway, it wasn't exactly the main way that asylum seekers were getting treated anyway. So we can expect that this isn't going to resume after, you know, the kind of current COVID policy of expulsion ends, given what happened last night. But at the same time, it's not at all clear what the timeline is for the people who theoretically are now in the are already in the program and have court hearings. And furthermore, the Biden administration said last night when it announced that it was going to stop new enrollments in the program, it went out of its way to point out that even under President Biden's immigration bill, people who aren't physically present in the United States right now wouldn't be eligible for legalization. So it did explicitly tell these people who are waiting in Mexico that because they were put into the Remain in Mexico program under the Trump administration, the Biden administration will not put them on the path to citizenship.
Yeah, so it remains an issue. And Laura, we have just a couple of minutes left, but, you know, one of the big parts of this bill was that there's going to be resources for addressing sources of migration in the first place. What would you tick through a couple of the top things you would like to see happen in that regard?
Right. So as most of your listeners know, the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, are plagued by immense and horrific gang violence that leads many, many people to flee from those nations. Those nations are also affected by climate change, which has led to the inability of many people to engage in sustainable farming and have sufficient food to have a livelihood for themselves and their families. And so what a regional system for managing migration would include is real direct supports to the governments of those countries to build safe and secure systems where people can live fulfilling, thriving lives and they don't feel the need to migrate. So that would include supports for non-governmental organizations. It would include supports for education, healthcare, and the supports needed in the home countries so people don't feel in danger of their lives and the need to flee.
We'll have to leave it there. Ilora Mukherjee is a professor and director of Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law. And Dara Lind is a reporter covering immigration policy for ProPublica. Thanks to you both for being here with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.